Hello and happy holidays, and welcome to the Christmas Eve episode of Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Dave Bedard.
At your Nutrien Ag Solutions retail, we take seed seriously. Getting it right for your farm requires the right knowledge. That's why we operate the largest retail seed trial program in Western Canada. Our local experts can provide you with advice for balancing maturity with disease traits and getting the best seed to your crop. After all, we take your harvest seriously too. Talk to your local retail today or visit NutrienAgSolutions.ca.
This is going to be our last episode for 2020, so this week we're going to check in with Bruce Burnett of Glacier Markets Farm to see what the new year may or may not have in store, both in ag commodities and in weather that's not behaving as we'd expect from a La Nina winter.
January is a cold month, so the temperatures will be cool, but certainly nothing like a big outbreak of below normal temperatures are expected so far.
Also this week, I don't know if the ice is thick enough yet out on the creek or the lake, but today we're all going to go skating with Alexis Stockford of the Manitoba Cooperator.
You know, man, you look at, you keep an eye on social media and you see some of the rinks that some of these guys have out there where it's, you know, they got full-time boards and floodlights and they've built home-built Zambonis.
First on the agenda today, though, we're going to talk about food, which is on everyone's mind this time of year, and COVID-19, which unfortunately is also still on everyone's mind this time of year, like we had a choice. As we saw earlier in the pandemic, many of Canada's livestock producers ran the risk of losing their markets as processors temporarily slowed down or shut down due to COVID outbreaks. And a lot of that processing capacity, particularly in beef, is centralized in very few and very big plants, where we saw a lot of workers in close quarters get very sick, and some who lost their lives as a result. When or if we get past this, we're definitely going to want to discuss whether business as usual is even an option anymore for the packing and processing sectors. And for that, we're going to talk to Jared Carlberg, a professor of ag economics and agribusiness at the University of Manitoba. He's just put out a new report on the subject this morning as we speak through the University of Calgary School of Public Policy. And he's on the line now. Dr. Carlberg, welcome to Between the Rows.
Thanks, Dave. Happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Now, obviously, COVID has affected more packers and processors across the country than just the big Alberta beef plants at Brooks and High River, but they do seem to be the poster boys for the problems that you outline in your briefing paper. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, I think I would go even further and note that that disease outbreak has affected meat processors around the world, certainly right across North America. Certainly, I think you're right on. We do tend to look at the so-called big guys like Cargill, like our plant in Brooks as well, when we talk about when we need a poster child for things that are happening in meat processing in Canada.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, with the big plants, economies of scale are the main reason that we pay what we do for burgers and steaks. And, I, for one, am thankful for that. But one of the options that you propose in your report is perhaps more smaller plants, you know, but not too small, you know, across a larger geographical area, which also seems like a pretty reasonable option to me. I mean, especially when you look at a province like Saskatchewan, which you did in your report. What's the upside and downside there?
I think you're right on the money with your assessment. We like our cheap burgers. We like our cheap steaks. We like cheap food in general. And so a researcher I worked with many years ago used to say the reason why food is expensive in Europe is they've starved through a couple of world wars and they've learned that food security sometimes is more important than cheap food. Of course, these days we would realize that a big component of food security for lower income Canadians and people around the world is the fact that it's become relatively cheap to produce very safe food. And so we all enjoy that. But I think certainly the prospect of introducing more regional meat processing, for example, would, there's no question that our large scale food processing system has evolved the way it has because of concepts like economies of scale, where we see that it's cheaper to produce things in large quantity and therefore sell them in large quantity. So it is a bit of a catch-22. We'd like to see fewer disruptions to our food supply chains when things like COVID-19 happen, but there would be a cost to that in terms of basically introducing additional inefficiency into the food production and processing system.
Mm-hmm. I mean, from the producer's standpoint, from the cattle producer's standpoint, it would seem to me that, that more plants would be a good thing. I mean, you're putting fewer miles on your trucks and fewer miles on your cattle, obviously, but is that necessarily feasible, though? I mean, from their perspective.
Well, I think people, I hearken back to the days of sort of the early 2000s, not too long, as we all know, in May 2003, BSE, bovine spongiform encephalopathy, was detected in a downer cow in northern Alberta, created long-term disruption in the Canadian beef market, closed our borders to exports effectively to the U.S. And so in the aftermath of that, one of the things people really had was, one of the ideas that was very common was, well, how come we're shipping beef to the U.S. at all? We're shipping beef from Western Canada or cattle to the U.S. to be slaughtered. We can't do that. Meanwhile, in Eastern Canada, we're importing beef that's processed in the U.S. Why don't we just build our own plants? And so as we've learned in the aftermath to that, it's really difficult to do that. Small-scale plants are much less efficient. You have to come up with new capital to fund them. I guess what I'm thinking in considering that option again maybe is we decided at that time there wasn't the political will maybe to do it or the capital that was out there. But now we've seen these kind of disruptions twice in less than 2 decades. So at what point are we gonna think maybe it's time to make some changes that would prevent those disruptions? By the same token, maybe people will do the calculus and say, we're willing to accommodate these disruptions every 10 years or so, or almost 20 years in this case, in order to have that cheap food, to have a system that's highly evolved in terms of its efficiency. My goal was to just to get people asking those questions as to if this was an option, how would it work and what would the costs and benefits of it be?
Mm-hmm. And to that end, you also look at alternative ownership structures, such as where producers take a direct stake in setting up more processing plants. But, we've seen multiple cases in Canada where that was tried and that didn't work out the way we all hoped. And, your report doesn't seem very keen on that option either.
It's a pretty good point. So almost 20 years ago, when I was finishing up my doctorate at Oklahoma State University, new generation cooperatives in the United States had enjoyed a period of pretty good, if you call it success through the mid to late 1990s. And so those were cooperatives that were started by farmers whereby they would deliver their products to, a somewhat local processing plant. Farmers would own the plant, reap the benefits of processing and the downstream value added. And there were some tremendous success stories. There were lots of failures. And I think that one of the things I did early in my career was look at why that had taken off in the U.S. so much more so than in Canada. We found that a lack of capital here, perhaps not as friendly a regulatory environment in terms of tax breaks, et cetera, not quite the same level in Canada as the U.S. So I still think it's a model that could work, but it would take a lot of capital. It would take a lot of support from the government, both in terms of changing regulatory structures and providing probably direct subsidies or support for construction costs, et cetera. So it was an option presented in the paper, again, just to say, here's something that if you were going to do those kinds of more regional scale processing facilities, here's a type of ownership structure that has been proven to work in some cases and would be reasonable given that what we're talking about is spreading processing out just a little bit more. If we're going to do step one, then maybe step two is to let farmers themselves have a greater ownership stake in these endeavors.
Mm-hmm. And, just the getting back to the idea of having more regional and smaller plant or sort of relatively smaller plants in general, it seems to me to be a win-win for producers in that respect. I mean, in theory, the law of supply and demand dictates if you've got more buyers in a market, then increased demand from separate players would support price. I mean, is that necessarily the case? I mean, just looking at the system we've got now.
I think it's a reasonable thing. It's a reasonable conclusion to come to. But you have to remember what we're really talking about is overall beef demand. So demand for cattle at the beef packing level is what we call a derived demand because it's derived from the overall demand for beef in Canada. And so there's probably not going to be increased demand for overall beef as a result of restructuring and reorganization of beef processing. It's just going to be that there would be more players in the market at that level. And so really what we're talking about is potentially increasing competitiveness among purchasers of finished or fed cattle rather than creating new demand. And so from a relatively high-level economic standpoint, I guess increasing competitiveness would, in theory, result in perhaps better prices to producers. Having said that, there have been many studies, both in Canada and the U.S., including one done years ago by myself and my colleague James Root at the University of Alberta, that looked at competitiveness in fed cattle purchases and have found that it's very, very difficult to prove that cattle buyers, packing plants essentially, are behaving in uncompetitive ways. It is a very, very low margin, high throughput business. And work similarly in the United States, when you do kind of back of the envelope calculations and say, hey, the so-called four firm concentration ratio, which is, say, the percentage of business done in the industry by the four largest firms, is massive, coming in Canada and the US at over 80% in general. And it that kind of makes you think intuitively there has to be a lack of competition. But when you get very deep into the operations of the plants and doing the work empirically on how much money they're making, well, which of course you're never going to know exactly, but you base it off of their input costs and things like that, it's actually surprisingly difficult to prove that there's anything anti-competitive going on there, which may in fact, of course, be a reason to conclude there isn't. But most people look at the high concentration ratios in some of the food processing industries and draw, you know, the obvious conclusion that it's not particularly competitive. Having said that, I'm quite sympathetic to the fact that these are extremely high cost industries as well in terms of processing, high risk, et cetera. And of course, subject to these cataclysmic occurrences where of course you have human health disease outbreaks that force them to close their doors for days or weeks at a time. So it's not a particularly pleasant industry to be in. I don't think there are a lot of people sitting down, you know, that have to hire extra people to count their money in these businesses. So it's a tough business to be in, but I also think there's opportunity for a potentially some more competitors, almost more as a strategy for enhancing rural incomes as opposed to really introducing a whole bunch more competition, which with the size of these packers nowadays, it's going to be difficult to get them to change behavior very much.
Mm-hmm. Which brings us to the option that that you discuss in your report as well, that's somewhat closer to the way things are now, or at least the way it's sort of more likely to shake out in the future. You know, we keep the economies of major scale, but we also reduce the amount of the number of human hands involved in processing. You know, how do you see that shaping up?
Well, I think it's been the outcome that we've seen. So much of the report, the first draft of the report, was actually completed pretty much exactly 6 months ago. So I was approached by the Institute for Public Policy to write this paper in spring of this year. The paper was completed relatively quickly by the middle of June. And so at that time I've said, and we knew far, far less at that time about how things would shake out. At that time, they were saying the vaccine might be a year and a half or 2 years away, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We didn't know much about how it spread, who were the most vulnerable populations, et cetera. And so I sort of thought at the time, what's likely to happen, the most likely outcome, the most realistic, is going to be that plants will respond by making their plants safer, by reducing the conditions for disease spread, et cetera. We've seen exactly that. I saw a number that Cargill, I believe it was, had spent hundreds of millions of dollars. I can't remember the exact number, but several hundred million dollars improving conditions in their plants throughout the U.S. Of course, they have the biggest stake in ensuring that they have a healthy workforce and a safe workforce. And they've made those investments, and things have become probably not quite more mechanized yet, as I foresee that they will in the future, perhaps with the construction of new plants, but certainly reducing interactions of people in common areas, spacing them out better, doing screening when people arrive at work in terms of ensuring that they're not at a risk. similar to what the rest of us have seen if we travel through airports, et cetera, now. So I think that third option that I've mentioned and identified as the most likely has indeed, in the short term, been what we've seen happen. And in the intermediate term, the long term, we'll see at an even greater level.
Are there any case studies yet that show where mechanization has been brought into such a degree as you're sort of foreseeing in the future?
I think the case study that most of us familiar with protein processing, animal protein processing in North America would say would be the poultry industry, where you look at the degree of mechanization is higher, and that's mostly because you're moving around, you know, 4 to 10 pound birds, or I mean, with big turkeys, a little bit bigger than that, but on rather than 1200 pound carcasses, you know, steer carcasses and things like that. So I think most of us would cite the poultry processing industry as being more mechanized, but of course with smaller animals and lighter animals, that's what you're going to see. So that would, I guess, be the case study. I haven't seen, although I'm sure there are out there plants in the say beef and pork industries that are much more highly mechanized than some of the older ones, not using perhaps the newest technology just because it's incredibly expensive to retrofit. But I do believe that will be something we see more in the future, and also workstations being developed perhaps in a way that will keep people a little bit more isolated from each other in these plants.
Now, what do we know about food safety from the mechanization perspective? I mean, is it better or worse with if you have fewer people involved? I mean, does the Hassett model of food safety, you know, favor necessarily having fewer eyes on the process?
That's a really good question, and so it's fair to say that, you know, increased mechanization leads to more surface area that must be sanitized. I think we all have in our minds the Listeria outbreak from a few years ago. And so it's certainly natural to ask. I guess I would hope that that due to that event and other food safety issues that have happened over the last few decades, that companies are becoming more and more skilled all the time at handling those issues and handling those issues in terms of having more mechanization and preventing surfaces from becoming unsanitary. But that's certainly a point worth considering.
Mm-hmm. Now, is there enough of an impetus, you know, once we, you know, when or if we get past COVID-19, you know, for the big packers that we have now in Alberta and elsewhere to try and retrofit for more mechanization? Or, you know, are they just more likely to say, you know, okay, everybody get vaccinated, then we're getting rid of all these shields and it's back to business as usual?
I would hope that they don't look at it that way. And they are very, very large, very sophisticated enterprise that do care at the end of the day about their employees. I've no doubt of that. And so I think that what they are likely to do, and we all know, and they certainly do as well, that I think every person on the planet hopes that this is indeed a once in a lifetime event, that we never see anything like this again. I think, however, everybody also needs to be aware that with increased travel, with increased conditions for disease spread, the next COVID or similar thing could literally be a year or two away or less. We don't know whether this virus will mutate in ways that make it more difficult to contain. There have been other similar disease outbreaks in recent years that just didn't turn out to be as severe, even though they were as easily spread. And so I think it would be very foolish for people to say, this is the last time this will happen. We know that, and we're going to go back to business as usual. Certainly very large, very sophisticated, very motivated companies to continue to be profitable, hopefully, and to continue to protect their workers are going to say, we need to ensure this, that conditions for this don't happen again. And I also expect that from a regulatory standpoint, governments will force companies to perhaps adopt some new best practices, although I've not heard how that might roll out in the next in the short to intermediate term.
Dr. Carlberg, thank you very much for your time today.
It was great speaking with you. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Dr. Jared Carlberg is a professor of agribusiness and ag economics at the University of Manitoba. You're listening to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Dave Bedard. Now, as I said off the top, the natural ice might not yet be thick enough for everyone's liking. I've already seen a couple of pictures on social media of pickup truck boxes sticking up through the ice, and a lot of the local rinks, both indoor and outdoor, are still closed or at least very restricted, you know, because COVID. But as we head into the winter break, some farm families are determined to bring some normalcy back into their kids' lives, and we're going to drop in on one such family now in this segment from Alexis Stockford of the Manitoba Cooperator.
The NHL may still be on hold, but every night there's still a hockey night in Canada. The scrape of skates along the ice, crack of a hard shot, the thud of the pucks along the boards. Backyard ponds and rinks flooded with the garden hose are keeping kids in the game.
We put the rink in here a few weeks ago. Once the ice got established, I would say like my boys are probably out there every second day for sure, if not every day. So it gets a fair amount of use.
Troy Basaraba's kids, Brody and Taryn, live north of Brandon, Manitoba, in the hamlet of Forest. Dad's construction is a silage tarp, covered in a few inches of ice and low boards. But Troy also knows that there's a world of choices out there when it comes to the backyard rink.
You know, it can vary. And I guess it kind of depends on your willingness to make it what you want, right? It can be very, very simple to, you know, if you got a flat chunk of ground, to just, you know, slap up some boards around the outside and drop a tarp in and then throw some water on, right? You know, that can be a very simple little investment, basically just a little bit of lumber. And I know some guys that actually don't even use tarps. They just, you know, drop the water straight onto the ground and away they go. So, but, you know, man, you look at, you keep an eye on social media and you see some of the rinks that some of these guys have out there where it's, you know, they got full-time boards and floodlights and they've built home-built Zambonis for their thing. Like, it can get to be a pretty significant investment. I actually heard yesterday that one of my buddies really upped his game and he input some LED lights. He actually built them into the ice, basically put down a layer of ice, put strong LED lights into it, and then flooded over top of it. So now all of his lights are inside the ice. So basically it's just cheap LED lights from, you know, Canadian Tire or something like that. But yeah, it would make like an awesome rink as well too. So lots of different design ideas out there.
Whether you dream of building your own Zamboni or laying lights inside the ice, Troy has a few tips on building a rink that will get you through the winter.
Oh, yeah, there's always like some little tips and tricks that you learn as you go and build these things, right? The first is, and I know this isn't, you know, depending on everyone's situation that changes, but trying to find the flattest chunk of ground that you can. It is absolutely amazing how much slope that you will have in your land. That is quite surprising. I thought my backyard was fairly flat, but, you know, once you start pouring water in there, you'll find out pretty quick that you can have 6 inches of slope in a very, very short period of time where it looks completely flat. So the other thing that I found was a colored tarp actually surprisingly will suck in a lot of heat from the sun and can actually be somewhat detrimental to making good ice. So using, like, say for example, like a white silage tarp is way more of a preferred option. You learn that one lesson the hard way. And then I guess the other kind of thing is just take some time and take some patience, right? Make sure that, you know, drop in a good base and then, you know, do some pop-up floods, get yourself a good couple of inches of ice, so that you're not running the risk of it cracking underneath as you're skating through. Cause, you know, you get a couple kids and a couple adults on it, there's some good weight. So get a good base going and then just kind of keep topping up and keep maintaining it. And if you do all that, you should be good.
This year, most rinks across the country share one thing, lockdown, or at least the threat of it. So has this year upped the ante for Troy's backyard rink?
I gotta admit, When I look at what the kids have gone through with regards to this whole COVID thing, you know, they've been pretty resilient. You know, as a parent, you kind of sit there, you go like, man, oh, I really hope that these kids kind of, oh, can get through this, you know, like the aspect of masking every day, like, you know, they never did this before. And how's my eight-year-old going to react to wearing a mask nonstop every day? And you have kind of like those things, is like, is this really going to affect them moving forward? And is it going to cause stress and anxiety and all that other sort of stuff? And I got to admit, these kids have actually just, you know, you throw a new little shift in the paradigm at them, and they're quite resilient. They at least mine have, at least anyways, where they've been presented with this challenge and adapted quite nicely to it. You know, when I look at the backyard rink in relation to all of this, did we need the backyard rink more this year than in previous years? Well, yes, because a lot of those other outlets, like you said, are not there. But it's maybe not as critical as I originally would have thought, just because they have been able to adapt to this new environment and stuff like that, right? So, but on that same standpoint, you want to make sure that you got a nice, healthy environment for your kids, and that being like, you know, good, you know, lots of fresh air and exercise and getting outdoors and getting active and all that other sort of stuff. So I think that's, you know, when some of those other things got locked down this year, yeah, then it does ratchet up some of the importance of things like the backyard rink to just for the kids' well-being.
That winter soundscape you've just been hearing comes to us from Alexis Stockford of the Manitoba Cooperator. You're listening to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Dave Bedard. If you've been following the market news on our websites recently, you've probably seen at least a few charts for canola and soybean futures, with trend lines more or less steadily on the upslope. Canola much more so than soybeans, in fact. Here to discuss that and what else we can expect or not expect heading into 2021, we have Bruce Burnett, Director of Weather and Markets with Glacier Markets Farm. Bruce, hi, and welcome back to Between the Rows.
Good to be here.
I apologize for talking about soybeans and so on. I've got snow on the brain right now. So just to reiterate, it's December 21st, and as we speak, and not that many days ago, we were oohing and aahing that canola crossed the $600 per ton line. That's looking kind of quaint right now, actually. Where the heck has canola been getting this extra lift from?
Well, I think there's two sources for it. First of all, we had a very bullish report from Statistics Canada earlier this month that indicated that stocks of canola this year are going to be extremely tight at the end of the crop year. And we've seen nothing but very good exports since that report came out. So that, on a weekly basis, has been reinforcing this idea that we're seeing strong demand for canola and strong use of canola seeds. So that's certainly been one factor. Couple that with a very good run-up in soybean oil prices as well at the same time has really pushed canola levels up into the, shall we say, stratosphere. We're trading around the 630 mark now today. And, you know, within a week or two, we could probably even be higher than that. So up into the $650 range. So it's really a very bullish move. We're now setting highs that essentially we haven't seen since 2013 in the middle of the summer. So certainly this is notable. I think the markets are paying a lot of attention right now to South America and that soybean situation down there, because they're entering the critical growth period and both Argentina and Brazil are on the dry side.
So of course, you know, what canola growers are going to want to know, I mean, this is the episode, pre-New Year's Eve episode, so we're being forward-thinking here. How long can we expect all this to continue?
Well, I think, again, we're going to see a market top at some point in time, but right now, all of the indicators are that prices are likely to move upwards. I think there will be a pause in the market, especially if we see some rains move into South America and those production numbers stabilize. But I think until we see a slowdown in demand, either from our domestic crushers or from the export market, the canola market is going to have to remain strong to help limit the demand for canola itself. Otherwise, we'll essentially draw it down to very, very low ending stocks at the end of this marketing year.
Mm-hmm. And soybeans, of course, started climbing as well. They passed the U.S. $12 per bushel mark a few days ago after a stretch of not much happening. Now, just to reiterate, who or what is driving that bus?
Well, it's much the same things as driving canola. You're seeing very, very strong soybean demand, especially from China. Total commitments for U.S. soybeans so far this crop year. And again, that crop year didn't start till September the 1st. So it's still in the first third of the crop year. You're looking at about 53, 54 million tons being already committed to export. So we're seeing very strong there. We're also seeing very strong domestic demand, setting new crush records for soybeans in the U.S. This fall. So the combination of the strong demand plus limited supplies, because like the canola numbers that we saw earlier this month, the latest numbers from USDA did point to a tightening of the soybean situation in the U.S. So we're going to see a pretty low carryout, relatively speaking, for the U.S. soybean market when we hit the end of this crop year.
Mm-hmm. And we also have another major grain and oilseed exporting nation that's kind of putting the brakes on exports. You know, obviously that bodes well for now, but can we count on that to continue?
Well, certainly Russia's installed some tariffs on wheat exports, as well as restricting the total amount of wheat exports from the middle of February through to the end of June. So that takes them through their season, the second half of the shipping season, into the start of when they harvest their 2021 crop. So it's an indication that Russia's a little bit concerned about the condition of their winter wheat crop, and that they're preferring to limit exports to help reduce inflation. The interesting point is that they're not only doing it for wheat, which is their major export, but also for sunflower oil and soybeans, because inflation in Russia has been increasing, and they want to depress the domestic price by limiting exports.
Mm-hmm. Now, just skipping ahead, we can't not look ahead to 2021 also without discussing weather. You know, again, it's December 21st, and we just had a decent overnight snowfall here in Winnipeg, with expectations for more. How are we on the track to have decent soil moisture here on the prairies this spring?
Well, I think we're still going to be challenged with soil moisture going into this planting season. We did see a big storm move through southern Alberta, up through most of the middle of Saskatchewan into northeastern Saskatchewan in November. We're going to see some reasonably heavy snowfall here this week, but overall, we're still on the dry side. And especially in the eastern prairies, where we've seen significantly below normal precipitation amounts from November through December. So we certainly haven't gained a lot, even with the recent snow, in terms of the amount of soil moisture that we have. Of course, the prairies went into this fall period in the central and southern regions with extremely low levels of subsoil moisture. So it's something we're going to keep a close eye on here, I think, as we move into the spring season, seeing how things set up from a rainfall perspective, because we certainly are going to need that rain in a timely manner in 2021.
Mm-hmm. And we seem to have a La Nina event that's still kicking around for a few months yet. What can we expect to get or not get from that?
Well, certainly this has not been a typical La Nina so far. The tendency would have been for cooler than normal temperatures throughout the winter season. And essentially, we've gotten off the hook here in November and part of November and December. So it hasn't been as nearly severe a bite as you would expect. Again, there's still January, February, and usually early March to go yet. So hopefully we can cross our fingers and we're not going to get those extremely cold temperatures and enhanced precipitation up in the northern growing areas. But that's what you would normally expect. But certainly, like anything else, this year has not turned out the way you expected it to.
Mm-hmm. Has there been any indication from any of the weather models out there that this is going to start, you know, behaving like a typical La Nina should?
Quite frankly, no. We've seen essentially a normal to above normal temperature pattern here that's going to exist through the end of the month here and in the first half of January, it looks like it's going to be fairly close in terms of normal temperatures. So, you know, again, January is a cold month, so the temperatures will be cool, but certainly nothing like a big outbreak of below normal temperatures are expected so far.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll keep watching the skies and watching the charts, and I'm sure we'll talk much more of all this on the other side of New Year's Eve. Bruce Burnett, many thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Bruce Burnett is Director of Weather and Markets with Glacier Markets Farm. I'd like to thank Bruce again, along with Alexis Stockford and Dr. Jared Carlberg, and our producers, Laura Rance and Bruce Thorson. The music tracks you heard today, by the way, were Coming Back by Lobo Loco and Earth and Sun and Leading Me On by Derek Clegg. On behalf of my fellow hosts, all the best for the holiday season. Between the Rows will be back January 7th with more from the Glacier Farm Media family of publications. I'm your host this week, Dave Bedard. Thanks so much for listening.
At your Nutrien Ag Solutions retail, we take seed seriously. Getting it right for your farm requires the right knowledge. That's why we operate the largest retail seed trial program in Western Canada. Our local experts can provide you with advice for balancing maturity with disease traits and getting the best seed to your crop. After all, we take your harvest seriously too. Talk to your local retail today or visit NutrienAgSolutions.ca.